Welcome everyone to What the Force, and welcome to a fun episode on the myth of Kenobi. And joining me for this conversation is John Booker. Welcome back.
Thank you, Marie Claire. This is so exciting to me to get to talk to you, but to get to talk to you about Kenobi? Come on. I mean, this is like dream come true status today. I am so excited about this conversation.
And people that might not know you.
Yeah. Which is most people, let's be honest.
Yeah. You are one of the hosts of the Skeleton Keys podcast and also the creative director of the Joseph Campbell Foundation.
I am. I am so privileged to get to co-host Skeleton Keys with the incomparable, amazing Tori Yates Orr. She's an amazing, amazing historian that I get to host that podcast with. And I get to work with the Joseph Campbell Foundation, as you've mentioned, and serve as their creative director. You know, a lot of what I try and do with the foundation is to not so much deify Joseph Campbell as much as look at how Campbell's work and the ideas that he was working with apply in our culture and how we can carry those ideas forward. Campbell was always really interested in how people might take his ideas and work and unpack those ideas, which is why he was so interested in the work of other people who were working with similar material. You know, he was a fan of Maria Gambutis. Mm-hmm. You know, he was a fan of Marie-Louise von Franz. These were all people that he admired because they were working with this material. And I think the way Campbell saw it was that this world of myth is like this giant brick wall that we're all building, and everybody gets to put a brick on it. And Campbell was just as interested in all those other bricks as he was the brick he was putting on the wall.
Yeah, and he references a lot of other people when he talks about things or a lot of other concepts. I know him and Maureen Murdoch had kind of a back and forth several times.
Yes.
And, you know, what I hope people understand is Campbell might be the start, but certainly he would never want it to be the end and be all.
Never. Yeah, I think he saw himself in many ways as that sort of launch point, you know, for a lot of people. When you look at, especially towards the end of his life, when you look at the power of myth and, you know, especially with that work, you know, he was off the charts intelligent, right? He had written these really complex works of literature. However, he was most interested in bringing these ideas down to a level that people could, the average person could understand it. And that's why I think the power of myth resonates with people still today, is that it's sort of brought to a level that average people like myself can understand it. You know, yeah. I only have so much brain power to spend, and I can get it, you know?
And Bill, like, asks clarifying questions. Do you mean X? And he's like, well, sort of. More like Y. And he's like, oh, Y. And he's like, yeah, Y. Yeah, like, and it, even though you can get it the first time, when you rewatch it, and I highly recommend if you've watched it before and maybe you were a kid or maybe you were much younger when you watched it, rewatch it again, because experience and life lessons and just even consuming new media will help you re-see it in a different lens every time that you watch it. It's fundamental to me, and it's always a great place. It's the first thing I recommend people dive into, because like diving straight into like Maureen Murdoch, again, of its time, some of the struggles that Maureen talks about from a heroine's journey perspective, specifically with her counseling patients that she was working with and therapy patients, just doesn't resonate with many modern femme people, right? And so it's interesting. I asked this question on our roundtable, and again, like it was an interesting question, so you could go back to that episode. But I said, you know, what would you want Campbell to be reading to be influenced by so he could influence Star Wars? And it's such like a roundabout question, but in a way, this is like that question was, I know Campbell wouldn't have stopped consuming new things.
That's right.
Incorporating that into his understanding, yeah. And nor should we.
Right. That's exactly right. Anytime with anything, we put a period at the end of the sentence when there should just be a comma, we've really done a disservice to whatever comes before that comma.
Mm-hmm.
Comma in the English language is meant for us to pause, right? We mm-hmm. pause and we consider that for a moment. But then we keep going, right?
Yeah.
The understanding keeps going. And I think in just about anything in life, when we put a period as opposed to a comma, we've rejected learning and we've rejected the possibility of what is to come. I sometimes frame it like this. A lot of times, we could get so angry with people that are not as far along in their understanding about these things. Like, it's easy for me to read things, you know, even that Campbell said and be like, ah, I would have liked to have had a conversation with him about that because I think he just, you know, he wasn't yet aware in their time of this or this or this. I think of it like this. There is no shame in being in fourth grade. Nobody makes fun of anybody for being in fourth grade, right?
Yeah.
However, if you're in sixth grade, that's great, right? Because you've progressed, you've grown, you've learned more. You're in sixth grade now. But a sixth grader should never shame a fourth grader, right? Someone who has not maybe made it that far in their thinking yet. And, you know, Campbell died. He didn't get to think anymore after yeah. that, at least in this dimension and plane. So I think we have to appreciate, wow, that was really interesting for someone who made it to the fourth grade. Now we're in the year 2022. We're in the 28th grade or whatever it is, right? And so I sort of look at it through that framework and say, wow, you know, some things people that lived in the 50s and 60s and 70s, you know, they had a certain way of understanding these things that we've grown and we've expanded and now we understand them much more accurately or much more thoroughly. Even in my work with the Campbell Foundation, some of the stuff that Campbell talked about, we've got better science for some of the things that he talked about. And we have to go back and we have to, you know, put an asterisk in some of the books and say, this was the best scientific thinking at the time about this, but now we know, blah, 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 blah. Mm-hmm. And I think we can easily dismiss people that have, you know, only made it that far into their thinking, or we can say, you know, this is an opportunity for me to transcend and include. Yeah. I still include everything that, you know, brought me to this point, and now I transcend it. And I'm so excited that, you know, people like yourself in this podcast keep taking ideas that Campbell and Marie-Louise von Franz and all these different thinkers had. And you're bringing those ideas into the world of Star Wars and into pop culture, and you're taking that work forward. And I'm so glad there's new energy and new thought coming out of that. If it was just if What the Force podcast was just a monument to the past, it would not be as successful as it is. But yeah. I believe it's a light shining towards the future. And I really do believe that. I'm a fan of the podcast. I'm so happy to be on it.
So two thoughts, and I totally agree with you. you just, you know, completely summarized how many Buddhists feel that if people aren't farther on their path of enlightenment, would you get mad at a child for not understanding everything around the world, right?
Yeah.
They're just not very far. And it's almost cruel to be mad at somebody who just hasn't had the opportunities to learn yet.
Yeah.
Right? Yeah. And also, there's a reason that the adventurer's journey.
Yes.
Or the journey that an adventurer goes on, which is more correct to what Campbell would talk about, which is also not gendered.
That's right. That's exactly right.
Really, really interesting. Campbell never called it the hero's journey.
Right.
It was other people that called it, and then he kind of adopted it. He's like, that's I guess. Right. But right. Yeah, it's the adventure. You as the adventure, or the person within the mythology, or the person within the story. And again, stories we tell ourselves, our dreams, our memories, are our personal mythologies. We are the adventurer that is trying to make sense of the disorder or chaos in the world around us and the things that have happened to us. We must be bravely departing on it, and it's a circle.
Yes.
So we never run out of time to take a new adventure and take a new journey and learn from the things that we have faced.
Oh, well said, Marie Claire. You are blowing my mind right now. That's so good.
I do have a podcast.
I'm so glad you do, because that is such an important perspective that you're bringing right now. And, you know, as you say those things, what I'm reminded of is that circular journey. It can look like we just keep repeating and coming back to the same place over and over. But actually, if we turn that circle on its side and lay it flat, what we're actually doing is we're creating that spiralic journey. It's a spiral that we're going deeper and deeper. And if you look at it again from an aerial view, it's just like, wow, you're just going in a circle, the same thing over and over and over. But what's actually happening is you're going deeper and deeper and deeper, as opposed to just repeating the same things over and over again.
You've given me words that I have wanted to hear for a really long time in a new way.
Oh, I'm so glad.
So one of the most important things in psychology is change journeys.
Yes.
And those are spirals.
Yes, that's right.
To go deep into the self, you know, at some point you're going to slip and you're going to go out.
Yeah, that's right.
Right? And that's to go into habit change, or to become something different, or to take on a new aspect of yourself, and you want to be like, it could be as simple as like, I want to have a regular exercise, or I want to take care of myself, or, you know, maybe I want to do something creative. There's going to be spirals where you're going to go away from where you wanted to be.
That's
and
right.
Change journeys are always like that. And so that's the link that I've always missed personally. So thank you, John, for giving that, which is that I always knew heroes' journeys were transformational change journeys, of course. But seeing you talk about it in that spiral down into the self really, really helps.
It really is so key to understanding that journey, because, and to be honest with you, that clarity about that came to me through the feminine myth of Persephone. I've learned so much thinking about the journey of Persephone. And, you know, most people are probably, you know, familiar with Persephone, you know, who spent part of the year in the underworld with Hades. And depending on which version of the myth you believe, there's, you know, probably the most common version of the myth is that she was brought there against her will. And there was a deal made with Zeus to let her come back to the regular world for part of the year, and then return to the underworld part of the year. I've always liked there's a version of the myth that suggests that perhaps Persephone planned the whole thing. She had fallen in love with Hades, and this whole thing was her plan to get to be in the underworld part of the year and the overworld part of the year. I always like that better, because I think it just
creates more agency on her,
it
too.
It does. Yeah. And I think Persephone is a character of agency. She represents that energy. But also, I think there's something for us to learn psychologically from that Persephone spent part of the year in the underworld and then would come back to spend time with her mother, Demeter. So many of us in our journeys try to, you know, we go to the underworld and we just try and just live there. We just sort of like, I'm just going to go on this deep journey of self, right? And just as you just said, sometimes we have to, what seems to be, go away from it. We have to move in a direction that feels like we're going away from it, but it's not. It's part of that spiralic process of going down deeper into it. And I think of it in terms, and this is a very Buddhist idea, but I think of it in terms of how we breathe. Mm. Inhales and exhales. And the journey of self involves the inhales that can cause us to lose our breath and can cause anxiety. Do you notice if you take a deep inhale, your body tenses up and the anxiety that's there?
Yeah. But
that exhale, right? It feels so good. The exhale feels so good. But life is about that balance of inhales and exhales. It's also something here, you know, when we get to talking about Obi-Wan Kenobi, that I think we'll see throughout this series is inhales and exhales. And I'm not just talking about the pacing of the story. I'm talking about with the character development of inhales and exhales. There's moments of inhales that are refusals of the call, right? Or that are like, you know what? Mm-hmm. You've come out here to the desert looking for this Jedi. Please go away. Obi-Wan Kenobi doesn't exist anymore. Don't just leave me alone, right?
Yep.
And then there's these exhales of, you know what? I'm going to save this little princess and you know, do what I need to do to get her to safety. And then there's an inhale that it's like, maybe this princess doesn't need saving at all. Actually, maybe she's going to be more my salvation than I'm going to be hers. She's over there fixing the situation in ways that I never could. So there's this constant inhale and exhale that's going on, even with the character of Obi-Wan Kenobi. I don't mean to just transition to the show, but I think the concept is seen there too.
Yeah, and you know, I think that having multiple ways to describe what you go through in this journey.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
Like Clarissa Pecola Estes would call it life, death, life cycle.
Yes.
There's a period of time where you are sort of spiritually dead.
Yes.
And if we were to look at like the whole Kenobi journey.
Yes.
And I do think that what happens in Obi-Wan Kenobi is maybe the most fascinating compared to like the Clone Wars. But if we look at the whole thing, he goes from, you know, all the way from his departure call to adventure in The Phantom Menace.
Yes.
All the way to the end of a journey, the master of two worlds in A New Hope and beyond.
And beyond, right.
And beyond.
Yeah.
I think like very quickly, the call to adventure is the fact that he believes that the Jedi and the Republic are good.
Yes. Yes.
And that there is waking up and seeing Naboo.
Yeah.
And what is happening as unfair and kind of like much of us, we look at the world around us and we're given this, not propaganda, but we're taught a certain way that we need to trust institutions and institutions are always good. Yeah. He learns institutions are not good necessarily. Yeah.
That's right. And part of that call to adventure that some people gloss over is the call to adventure often is simply a dissatisfaction with the status quo. Mm-hmm. That
you've something that feels off.
That's right. Yeah, yeah. Exactly. And I think that's exactly what we see with Obi-Wan Kenobi is there's a dissatisfaction that is unbearable to him. He can't just, we see he's a guy who actually is very capable of going off and isolating himself and having nothing to do with anyone when he finds the situation to be difficult. Mm-hmm. We see this in his character over and over, right? Mm-hmm. So the fact that we see, you know, when this call to adventure occurs with his character, the fact that we see him actually unable to resist, but that he must actually address this dissatisfaction that he's feeling, that is worth noting, and it's powerful because we end up learning he's very capable of rejecting the call. Which is, again, a part of that, you know, adventurer's journey is that rejection of the call. And Obi-Wan Kenobi is a character that he can reject the call. He has no problem rejecting the call.
I think it's really important to say that, like, in the Obi-Wan Kenobi show, it is a full hero's journey.
Yes.
But then his entire life can also be looked at as a full hero's journey.
Yes.
In the show itself, you see all of the steps, and then you can see all of the steps if you look at his whole journey. But the show itself focuses on sort of where he starts, which is, if we were to like look at his whole, again, life that we have seen, at his catabasis, which is that he doesn't realize things are wrong, but yet he kind of itches and he knows it's wrong.
Yeah. Well, the powerful thing there that I take from what you just said that's so intriguing to me is I think about Obi-Wan Kenobi on this micro level of this season of the show. I think about him on this macro level of this long journey from, you know, episode one forward. And then I think about the fact that we often associate an archetype with a particular character. This character embodies this archetype. Mm. And the very first time that we meet Obi-Wan Kenobi in episode four, he is like the greatest example of this mentor, wise old sage archetype, right? But I think what's brilliant about the character of Obi-Wan Kenobi is how seamlessly they're able to move him out of that mentor, wise old sage archetype into being the hero archetype, right? You know, he moves from one archetype to another quite seamlessly, in the same way that we see Leia's character now as a child. I love seeing Leia as a child. And this goes back to a lot of Jungian ideas, you know, about the cynics and the pu'er and this pu'er energy of the child. Mm-hmm. We see Leia as this pu'er energy of the child, but later we see Leia develop into this heroine, right? Mm-hmm. Archetype. And then also we see Leia later develop into this
mentor,
right?
Or even sort of semi good crone like. They never really allowed her to be like Baba Yaga or dirtier, like she even isn't allowed really to express her grief, which I struggle with personally.
Absolutely.
But yeah, exactly. And you made a really interesting point before the show, and I did want to bring it up, which is that it's very mythological to sort of have the handoff of generations.
Yes, yes.
Right? To see the cycles where somebody starts out and you literally see them as a teenager, like Obi-Wan, and see his entire life and see him become the mentor and see him fail and see him take on next steps. And, you know, our hope is that we actually see some of our heroes have the freedom to live a peaceful life somewhere. Yeah.
Well, I love that you have raised this, because you're absolutely right. You know, mythological traditions, you know, from the Mahabharata to the Judeo-Christian tradition that we're more familiar with in, you know, the West. And I'll pick an example from that, because a lot more people would be familiar with it. Look at the character of David in the Judeo-Christian myths. So this character of David, we learn of when he's a young boy. He goes and he slays this giant Goliath, right? And this is where he begins. Then we follow this character up through his young man hero phase, where he's a warrior. Mm-hmm. Then we follow him into where he becomes the king, and he becomes the king, you know, that rules over the land. And then we follow him up to where he's the old man king, and he's kind of this staunchy, you know, mean old king. And then he dies, and his son Solomon becomes king, right? And then we see Solomon's whole journey. And you know, in that mythological tradition, we see the entire death, birth, mm-hmm. rebirth cycle going through over and over again between generations, because mythology is not a journey of the singular ego. It is a journey of the entire collective recycling yeah. over and over and over again, which is what Star Wars is doing so brilliantly. And it's also becoming a really academically correct mythology, if
yeah.
you will.
Yeah, it is. Yeah. And it's also hard for, I would say, some people, because they've grown up with a specific liminal space by which their heroes never change.
Yes.
Or they're stuck where they are. So like a lot of people, especially men, I would yeah. say, no offense.
I totally agree. None taken.
struggled with The Last Jedi and yeah. the fact that Luke wasn't all powerful in that moment. Yeah. He was down and he was depressed, but we see that parallel to Kenobi so easily. Yeah. There's so much of The Last Jedi in the Obi-Wan Kenobi show because these things are repetitive and we need yeah. to learn them again.
That's right. That's right. That to me is, that's why it's hard, I feel like, to tell powerful mythological stories in television. And I'm so glad that we have creators like Dave Filoni and Jon Favreau and
Deborah Chow?
That's exactly where I was going next. Because Deborah Chow, I think, has taken it to an entirely new level with yeah. Kenobi. Honestly, it's so difficult to make that work in television because we want to see the character stay the same. Let's take it out of Star Wars for a second. Let's take it sure. to another nerd culture. Look at, you know, the superhero genre. Mm. Look at, you know, everything from Batman to Spider-Man. I give love to DC and to Marvel there. In essence, we know who those characters are, and they are never going to fundamentally change. Like, we see little moments of growth, right, in these characters, but they never fundamentally change who they are, and Star Wars is not quite as confined by those things.
Yeah.
Star Wars has sort of built its ethos on the fact that we learn, wow, you mean to tell me Anakin Skywalker was once the hero?
Once a child?
Right.
Once a child. Once an innocent, compassionate child?
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. That's, yeah. And, you know, in Kenobi, I know that a lot of people may, you know, disagree with this or give me flack, but I was probably the most interested in Third Sister of all the characters because she not only to me seemed like the most complex character we've been given in the Star Wars universe by, you know, this experience that she had as a youngling. We're also seeing like three different phases of human psychological development all trying to be worked out at the same time through the same character in the same show. Mm-hmm. Now, this, again, I'm quite sure we can tip our hat to Deborah Chow about because I...
Or the writers. The writers also.
The writers, yeah. Absolutely. The writers as well. Yeah. I mean, but it's incredible to watch Third Sister move through this angst about, you know, there's the moment when she has the opportunity to destroy Vader, right?
Yep.
And she's behind him and, you know, she's like, all right, this is my moment. I'm going to take it. This is what it's all boiled down to for me, right? And we feel the intensity of how many years she's waited for this moment. And then to have it snatched away from you and him to turn around and be like, did you honestly think I didn't know, you know, that you... It to me, it's one of the most human moments in all of Star Wars, because how many times have I spent years moving towards some goal that I had, and then when it came down to that exact moment, something is snatched away and I realize, oh man, I was so focused on achieving that goal, I missed the bigger picture of what was actually happening here. And it was such a complex moment. How did that moment land with you when you saw it?
What I was really struck by is that in many ways, Vader is both the shadow of Obi-Wan and Reva, right? Because of, and Anakin specifically is the shadow of both of them. Yeah. But in that moment, Reva is standing as the shadow to Vader. Yeah. And she is, the universe stops her from becoming Anakin.
Yeah. Yeah.
Like, or Vader, right?
Yeah.
The universe multiple times in a Deus Ex Machina kind of way will not allow her to become Darth Vader like he was.
Yeah.
And it all enables her to be able to give the elixir to Luke.
Yeah.
Compassion to Luke. And thus, Luke can give compassion back to his own father.
Yeah. Oof. That, you know, as you were saying that, it caused me to reflect here for a moment just on... It caused me to reflect on, you know, the true nature of an antagonist. Because when I found out, you know, that she was going to be the antagonist in this season, I was curious to see how the writers would unpack this. And honestly, I'm ashamed that I forgot some of my story training around antagonists, because so often we think about an antagonist as wanting the exact opposite thing that the protagonist in a story does. And that's so not true. In a good story, the protagonist and the antagonist want the exact same thing.
Mm.
So the protagonist and the antagonist in this story both want to stop Vader.
Yes.
They just have two different means of going about it.
One could argue that Anakin also wants to kill himself.
Ooh. Now we're getting into it, aren't we? I mean, yeah, I think you're right.
He said it multiple times.
Yeah, yeah.
So we got to believe him.
Yeah. Well, and so here's we do got to believe him.
Because
Reva
is an anima of Vader in the story.
Right. You're right.
It's Reva is Anakin's femininity, the thing that he has had to kill to become Vader, and the thing that is trying to kill Darth Vader.
You are blowing my mind with this Reva's anima, because I had not thought of that, but you're 1,000% correct about that.
And, and they made her his shadow in that moment.
You're right. Wow. Okay. Now my mind is officially
And they're in blown. A cave.
They're in a cave. Come on. Oh, wow. Yeah. Now, I'm just exploring this with you here as we talk about it.
Let's
I haven't thought about this. This is fun.
Yeah.
Yeah, right? So in the final episode of the season, this big epic, you know, lightsaber battle between Anakin as Vader and Obi-Wan Kenobi, there's like three moments here that strike me in that battle that I think connect here to what you're saying. And I'd be interested to play with you around these ideas here.
I love it.
One is, in a sense, maybe Anakin/Vader. Now, let me rephrase this. Maybe Anakin is witnessing a battle between Vader and Obi-Wan Kenobi, that he's actually rooting for Kenobi to strike victorious. But there's another part of me that says, no, you know, at the beginning of that battle, Anakin's ego is unbelievable, right? He straight up tells Kenobi, this is not going to end well for you, pal.
Symbolically.
Yeah.
It's that his ego and his persona have merged.
Oof.
Right? Because his persona is represented by the Vader mask. So the mask that he wears on the outside.
Somewhere, right? Carl Jung is smiling in his grave right now as he hears you say these things, because you're so spot on.
And then when his persona is stripped, i.e. his mask is broken, we can truthfully see the blue light, the remnants of Anakin with his eye remaining. And he's actually able to speak and give atonement to his father figure, which is the reverse of the typical atonement of the father.
Right.
Atonement to his father figure, Obi-Wan, that what happened wasn't his fault. It was his own fault. And to understand that guilt, and that the person that hates Vader the most in the galaxy is Darth Vader, or is Anakin, it is the reason why he's stuck in his catabasis, right? So what I find super interesting throughout the show is that they do twin.
Yes.
Symbolism, like when they're both in the Bacta tanks, and in that episode where they end up in the caves, and they do twin symbolism, and it's like Castor and Pollock, right? Like the idea that they are both at the same place at the same time in their journeys, and Obi-Wan, through atonement and apotheosis, is able to finally move past that point, so that eventually he can give the lessons learned to Anakin's own son, so that he can give it back to him.
Yes. Well, yes. In that battle, when Vader brings down all the natural world on him and buries him under the soil of that earth, we've got multiple archetypal moments happening right there as well, because we have a belly of the whale moment in a classic, you know, sense. We've also got
Barady's finally dead.
That's right. He's finally dead. That's right.
Under the ground.
Under the ground. Under completely
ready,
buried.
Ready to be reborn.
That's it. Is we've got the actual death and rebirth that is witnessed. And after the rebirth, there's this moment that we see Obi-Wan actually begin to control the nature around him, where he raises up, you know, the trees and the limbs, and
he's suddenly powerful,
right?
He's got that demigod connection, right?
Absolutely.
to the Force. And that's like, that's where what happens when you actually are able to get your shadow and understand what's happened.
Yes.
And fully understand it, you become integrated. You become whole. And that means that there isn't pieces of you that are fighting against each other, like what's happening with Anakin and Vader, in that there are pieces of himself that he's not whole. He is, in a bell hooks way, emotionally mutilated.
Yeah.
And how you move past that into wholeness is by understanding the things that have happened to you, your shadows, your darkness, the things that you're projecting out there in the world, and bring them all together in some ways. A lot of people that talk about the hero's journey talk about it as putting order into chaos, right? Like you're putting, I don't know if it's that. I don't know that you can ever really, you know, become cool and like ordered with your darkest desires or the things that you've done in the past, but you can understand them and you can move past them or put them in the right place in a Bly perspective, right? Get your garbage bag in order.
Get your garbage bag. I think you've brought up something that is so key for people to understand, I think, about, you know, any sort of monomyth related idea. And that is, you know, that when Campbell identified the monomyth, he wasn't trying to present it as being prescriptive. He was presenting it as descriptive, saying, this is what I see happen in this journey of all these people looking back. He wasn't trying to say, so you should go, you know, try and do this, and then you should go try and meet your mentor, and then you should go have a meeting with the goddess. He was saying, no, this is how things tend to unravel as we journey through the individuation process.
Yeah.
Right? This is just sort of what happens. And you can, when these things arise, you can be like, oh yeah, I see this is happening. But so many people then try and put a hand on that and I think manipulate the process and drive it. And that's always a mistake, I find.
Yeah. There's this line, you know, it's not the work that inspires, it's the creator that absorbs.
Yeah.
It, like, how you know that it's going to speak to your brain is that the creator isn't trying to use the template. They're trying to speak from a deep part of themselves that needs to speak. And then it will speak to the deep part of you. And that's why what I call resonance, right? Like, it's resonating with me because I can feel it deep inside. I always know that's the case when I have weird dreams after I've watched a piece of media.
Yeah, yeah.
You know? But... like, what's really important about Kenobi himself is that through his whole journey, like anytime we've seen him on screen, and I'm only talking about screen time, including, you know, the Clone Wars, which is really his road of trials.
Absolutely.
There is no doubt. But his entire screen time shows how a person downfalls.
Yeah.
In their belief in the institutions or the culture that they're in, and then how they get out of that, which is what we've gotten in the Obi-Wan Kenobi show, right? It's how you get out of your lowest point. And people are entirely okay to use it like that, right? If you need an example of how a person gets out of just cutting desert manta ray in the desert and becomes like, I joked in my pre-episode where I was like, this is what he's going to go through. He's at his catabasis. I don't know, you know, where he's going to get probably to his apotheosis, but I'm happy to see he got to the ultimate boon. You know, like I said, this is how Obi-Wan Kenobi gets his groove back. And like, that's really what this is all saying. And then how do you go on to give that to others? Because one thing that's really, really important about what Campbell was always talking about, the description aspect, is that how do we make the internal externalized?
Yeah.
And that's the return. That's the post Obi-Wan Kenobi show.
Yeah.
Is you know, A New Hope, and then, you know, how he's mentoring Luke later on.
Absolutely. That's such an interesting question, you know, of how do we, you know, get that back? And this is where I think Obi-Wan Kenobi as a show does this really fine job of balancing asking profound questions with trying to demonstrate how people get their groove back, or how people get, you know, it's nice because it's not preachy and saying like, well, here's the answer for everyone. You know, it asks these profound questions that sometimes we don't get great answers for, but it also does show how people move forward.
Yeah.
Within a journey. And that's in some ways, I think, part of the strength and the power of the show, at least for me as a viewer, in that it shows me respect as a viewer by not giving me simple answers, but still showing me a bit of a roadmap, you know, forward.
It's show, don't tell.
Yeah, exactly.
Right? Yeah.
Exactly. Yeah.
And that's really, really, it's what... George doesn't like to talk about what he's trying to do. I think he should, personally. he does occasionally. And Dave Filoni also doesn't like to talk about what this is doing.
Right.
And so I guess this is why podcasts like mine exist, to say this is what this is doing. But they want you to feel it.
Yeah.
Right? Yeah, they want you to feel it. They want you to embrace the story, because then it's you're walking the journey with the character.
Yeah. Yeah.
So when we are disillusioned with our institutions, and Obi-Wan Kenobi has anti-institutional, like, all written all over it, right? We're disillusioned with the institutions that have fallen apart for us.
Yeah.
How do we pull ourselves back together as an individual and then understand that we have a role in the larger galaxy and return mm-hmm. to help others.
So here's my theory. I'm going to just float a theory at you. See what this brings up for you. I believe Dave Filoni has this really interesting subtext. And I say Filoni in particular because, again, this is we look at who are the through-line voices in The Mandalorian, in Clone Wars, in Obi-Wan Kenobi. And so I'm going to stick it to Filoni, but maybe it's somebody else. But here's my theory. I think when we look at let's start with The Mandalorian. When we look at Grogu being the boon that is brought back to the community, we could say in Obi-Wan Kenobi, it is Leia that is the boon that is trying to be brought back to the community, because in the same way that the Mandalorian is trying to bring Grogu somewhere, Obi-Wan Kenobi is trying to take Leia somewhere. He's trying to get her somewhere, which is characteristic of the boon. So could we say then that Filoni in the subtext is saying the boon for in the journey of humankind is our humanity. That's what must be brought back to people. Even Grogu as a character represents, in my humble estimation, the purity and innocence of our humanity. I think it's not lost on me that Leia is a child, Grogu is a child. So we keep having the child brought back.
And I know why.
Tell me why.
Okay. I got help a couple me. Of thoughts. So
help me, Marie Claire. You're my only hope.
Yeah, there's a third show that is also doing the same thing.
Okay.
But the Bad Batch.
Bad Batch. How could we forget Bad Batch?
So I call this the masculine nurturing fantasy. Right? Instead of instead of the female power fantasy.
Yeah. Oh, right? Wow. Yeah.
Right? So in a Bell Hooksian kind of way, what they are saying is, and Giancarlo Esposito actually said this straight up on stage, so I know somebody said it to him directly. He said, I am excited to reconnect with my inner child, just like Grogu.
Okay.
So what are children like before they are, I don't know, emotionally mutilated by the patriarchy?
Yeah.
They love. They're like Anakin. They are nothing but love and compassion.
Yes.
And what we are saying to primarily the men in the audience is that you cannot be separated from your emotions. You have to love. You have to care about the next generation. You have to care about the inner child within yourself that was never allowed to love.
This, you're going to make me cry on this podcast. Is that your whole goal, to bring me here and make me cry? That is so beautiful. That's so beautiful. That, I think you're spot on.
Yeah, because like, who needs to hear this message better than male Star Wars fans? You know, that you cannot be just all about, and it's one of the reasons I have problems with the Luke hallway scene in the end of Mandalorian season 2 is like Luke himself would find another way. I feel like that was just a very, and one of my problems with Mandalorian in general is that it takes the humanity, it takes the feeling lens out of the conversation, because everybody is essentially an action figure. Even the characters that have faces and are alien, like, you know, we got different bounty hunters in Book of Boba Fett and everything like that. Uh-huh. They're voiced and they're, you know, like everything is kind of like puppets.
Yeah.
And that is a method, but you see the difference in a Deb Trow storytelling when we get emotions on characters' faces, even with Ned B, the robot, right?
Yes.
Because of the body language, we feel Ned B's emotions. And so that's where what Joey Salloway would call other gays is really, really important for embracing this mythic storytelling structure is that we need to not only tell a mythic story that involves a change journey like we see in Kenobi, right? Coming, getting his group back. But we also need to do it in such a way that we see it layered in the emotions of the character to go through it. So then we can psychologically go through it and experience that with the character, right? That's good storytelling.
Yeah.
And then you see it reflected in the story when you hear characters tell the character they're doing things.
Yeah.
And that's that's Joey Salloway and that's femme gaze or other gaze.
Yeah.
All the way. And it's what I've been asking for from Star Wars.
Yeah.
Since The Last Jedi.
Oh,
because it will resonate. Yes. It will resonate faster if you tell it on multiple levels like that.
Yeah. Well, that, you know, I love that you're bringing in this idea of the gaze. It takes me back to, you know, years and years ago when Laura Mulvey, you know, wrote initially about the masculine gaze and the male gaze, and it got simplified down to this idea that it was the sexualization of women, that the male gaze was basically just the sexualization of women.
It's actually an objectification of all.
That's exactly it. It's not.
You're not a person. You are an object.
Well, and that's what I love. What you were saying about the Mandalorian of turning everyone into action figures is there is aspects of what that male gaze then is at its core suffers from.
But
is,
we get really good episodes in the Mandalorian universe when they are directed by women.
Oh.
Like
Bryce Dallas Howard.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Stephanie Green. Deborah Chow.
Yeah. Isn't it interesting? Now, see, I have a question for you then. Of the future Star Wars stories that will be told in the future, is there an existing femme representing character that you think has the most potential to be unpacked by a femme storyteller in order to explore this on the next deeper level? Yeah. Or does it need to be a fresh start, a new character altogether?
I'm most excited for Acolyte because I respect the showrunner so much, and also probably an exploration of darkness, which is rare for women in Star Wars. You know, I'm digging into that right now just to be able to record on that. But I have concerns about Ahsoka. Just because she tends to be personified, and I don't know if it's because she's literally in a way Dave Filoni's baby, metaphorically his baby, but literally his child. Like, you know, and she tends to be infantized even as a grown ass woman.
Fair.
I don't know, right? And in general, it depends on what sort of lens is being used for her.
Yeah. I am excited to see, you know, what they do with these existing characters, but there's another part of me that's even more excited about the future of new characters that will be created. You know, if say they hand Deborah Chow the reins and just say, go create a Star Wars show based on a character that you invent, that you create, that... Because I don't think we've seen yet in the Star Wars universe anything like that. You know, I think most people are working with the existing archetypal energies that came out of George Lucas's original trilogy. And not that we haven't expanded into all sorts of different worlds, but I'm anxious to see... something that addresses these things that you're talking about, that gets to start from as much of a clean slate as possible.
I would say that as closest as that has ever happened in Star Wars was with the Knights of the Old Republic game, the original one, where they said, we don't want to mess with the Skywalker saga. Yeah. Yeah. So we will go so far back in the past.
Yeah.
We can't, but it kept all the echoes and the understanding of what George was trying to say.
Yeah.
And it built it. It built its own world with characters that are beloved, right? Yeah. Revan and Bastila and Karth and IG, I forget his name. Or that,
IG-88.
No. He's the assassin droid. I literally cannot remember his name, but he's great.
It's okay.
But that sort of idea, and I, truthfully speaking, I think if they go back in time and tell the Jedi Mandalorian War or the Jedi and Sith split or something along those lines, which allows them to lean more heavily into fantasy, because I feel like they've gone more horror science fiction, especially with time, with cloning and with the horrors, body horrors of, you know, Sith arts and stuff like that. Like it feels very science fiction-y sometimes. Right. I think that it could go sort of high fantasy Star Wars, and that creates more opportunities to lean into emotionality of storytelling, which would tell new journeys that tell the same thing, but from new perspectives and new interesting plots. And you could create new beloved characters from scratch, right?
I like what you say there about bringing in the fantasy genre to go back and tell those stories, because I think I loved, you know, the Western genre getting, you know, intermingled into, you know, the more recent Star Wars stories that, you know, is greatly a result of, we know, Dave Filoni wears the cowboy hat everywhere, right? He loves Westerns, right? But I think, you know, the genre of the Western is amazing, but it has its limitations too. And I think going to the fantasy genre also will open up the feminine in some very different ways, where sci-fi tends to lean into a lot of masculine energies and technological ideas, where fantasy, I think, opens doors of possibility that sci-fi is just not going to open.
In Western storytelling, most journeys end at the refusal to return.
Right.
You never have the healing of the community by the hero and the freedom to live.
Yeah. Yeah.
And that could be because George was so influenced by the Searchers and other Western storytelling. But then he got past that in Return of the Jedi and allowed Luke to live.
Yeah. Yeah.
Right. So I don't know. Why fantasy? Fantasy tends to at least be more psychologically archetypical, leaning into mother goddess archetypes. Because a lot of femme magic comes from that. Right. And so also, you can bring back really cool concepts like the Night Witches, which are dark feminine and also just natural power, which is uncontrollable and like by men, right? And so that's another reason why I'm really interested in the Acolyte, of course. But with fantasy, you can lean into Campbellinian concepts of like how he explored the Knights of the Round Table and Percival, Tristan and Isolde. Like you could have like sort of more of the courtly love concepts in that as well, because they're called Jedi Knights for a reason.
Right.
The Mandalorians wore armor for a reason.
Right.
There are counts and princesses and sort of feudalism,
right,
which explores the interconnectivity of us all.
Yes.
Right? This right. is mine, this is yours, but how do we come together? How do we how do we find that third way that we're always talking about? You know, and it just creates like a really rich and interesting place to tell stories that does not rely on what your name was and who your dad was.
Yeah. Well, you I think nailed it with if they do go back and tell stories that are further back in the past than where the Skywalker story begins, we have the opportunity to mirror what has been true of mythology, and that is that feminine cosmology is much more ancient than any male cosmology. You know, we had we had goddesses long before we had gods, and so these ideas you're talking about with the knights and the feudal societies that we see, think of that in terms of the planet we live on, and that was a certain point in history. But if you go back further in history, you're going to go to Inanna and Ishtar, these more ancient feminine goddesses in energies, that it would be so fascinating to keep going further and further back in the Star Wars narrative to see if that mirrors, like, if somehow the feminine energies, if there was, these Inanna-like stories that were lost when societies changed, just like we lost so many goddess stories when, we went from the agrarian societies to the hunter-gatherer societies. It would be so fascinating to see if that held true in the Star Wars mythos.
Well, they would just have to write it, right?
Absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely. Yeah. They should bring us in to talk to them about writing it, right?
Yeah. I mean, they'll be fine. Yeah.
I'm sure they will.
But we have gone all over the place, but I think that's really exciting. And John, I can't wait to actually have you back on the podcast to talk more about mythology. And it... before we recorded, we were like, it's like we're talking to people we've known our whole lives but have never met. Like, that's what it was like when I met John. And I really, really appreciate and really am so thankful that you agreed to come and talk with me again.
Well, this is awesome. It is my pleasure. I'll come back anytime. And in the meantime, I am, again, big fan of the podcast. Thank you for the great work that you do. I can't wait to hear what insights you continue to hold, because I learned so much about all of these things by listening to you, Marie Claire. So thank you, thank you, thank you. It is a honor and a privilege to be here with you today.
Where can people find you if they're looking for what you're doing and what you're all about?
You can find out everything about me, connect with me on all my social media platforms. If you go to my website, it's tellingabetterstory.com.
And also check out Skeleton Keys, which is awesome.
Yes.
Exploring sort of mythology and pop culture and symbolism and archetypes and things like that. So really, really amazing. Thank you, John.
Thank you so much.
Thank you for listening to What the Force. I'm Marie-Claire Gould, your host. Our music is provided by Christy Carew for What the Force. We have a Patreon at patreon.com/whattheforce. We would like to thank all our patrons, especially those who love and are obsessed with What the Force. Cheryl, Melody, Night Huntress, In Wild Space, Felicia, How Rude, Anna Perez, Neil, Joe Allen D, Christian Luca, Josh Johnson, Scott C, and Susan. Make sure to like and subscribe on YouTube or leave a 5-star review on iTunes or other pod apps. It helps people find the show. Check out our other channel on YouTube, What the Fiction. You can connect with us on Twitter at WT4Show, What the Force Podcast on Facebook, and our website, whattheforce.ca. We also have a Discord. Links are in the liner notes. Feel free to reach out and start a conversation. Cheers.